Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. We're happy to have back with us on the program Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. She's affiliated with the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. Every other month, she is here, and we talk about women's health. The idea is it's a regularly occurring opportunity for you to ask questions. Any of the kinds of things that she deals with in her practice are certainly welcome. And in the past, we've talked about various aspects of women's health. Certainly, we've talked about contraception and pregnancy planning and birthing and menopause and osteoporosis and a very wide range of subjects. And certainly, any of those kinds of things, I'm sure that she would do her best to answer questions. She also came prepared to talk about a few things, so we have that. But I want to make sure that people who are listening know that we are here open to your questions, just as long as people do. Also keep in mind that the doctor cannot diagnose over the telephone. There are limits as to what we can do because she can't see you. And if you have concerns about your health, obviously you should pursue that with a physician who can see you. But this is a place where you can get some basic information and ask some questions, and that's why we do these shows. So if you'd like to call in and talk with the doctor, 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you just give us a call, and we'd be very happy to talk with you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Glad to have you here. There's a number of things that you said maybe you could talk a little bit about. I don't know if there's any particular order you want to take things in.
I take them as they come off the news wires, probably like you do.
Okay.
I thought I would start a little bit about talking about electronic records and personal health records, and people are going to be hearing a lot more about that, and I encourage everyone to talk with their own physicians and utilize any electronic access that they might have. It's important, number one, to find out what electronic variations you have in your own healthcare provider's office, just so that you can get your information when they do keep these records electronically. You often have access where you can update your record. There are a lot of challenges. There are at least 200 extremely reputable companies trying to develop products that physicians and hospitals and clinics will be using. So there's a lot of competition, which is good, but there are challenges making sure all these systems can talk to each other. I have about four or five systems right now going in my own private office, and they don't all talk to each other completely. So that's definitely a challenge. But moving into this electronic era is going to really help us a lot. And I would say within 5 years, all of us will be emailing our physicians and getting answers back. I already talked to my patients by email, but I know a lot of physicians don't yet, but I think they will.
Well, that's here. This raises in my mind a number of questions. But since you mentioned that, that would be one right off. I would think that many physicians might be concerned that, you know, they have plenty to do now, but if they're suddenly getting emails from patients that they're going to have to sit down and read and respond, that could add significant, depending on how many patients you have and how eager they are to do this, this could add significantly to your workday.
Well, it could. Of course, you talk to patients too, and you answer phone calls from patients. And I say that I get emails, and of course, I do have a staff that can help me with this volume of work as well. And there are codes that physicians can actually bill and get reimbursed. And it's, again, a new area, and most of us are not getting any billing or reimbursement for this.
So if somebody sends you an email, they'd have to pay for the...
Not yet, no. But yes, this could be a several-tiered system, and it could be something as simple as emailing my receptionist to change an appointment, something like that, something efficient, something where instead of me playing telephone tag with a patient to say, hey, send me your updated blood sugar logs, they can mail those in. So there are definitely ways that email could add to your workload, but there are obviously ways where this could add to efficiency. But you're right. One of the biggest challenges is to try to figure out, okay, where now do we handle all this data input? Mm-hmm. And if you have several physicians, who's going to be in charge of when this data comes in, who's going to be in charge of your blood sugar information? Is that going to be your gynecologist? Is that going to be your endocrinologist? Is that going to be your family provider? So these are challenges that are going to have to be worked out. Some of this, the government's looking over our shoulders and trying to help us figure out. And some of this, it's going to be your individual clinic. Perhaps even your malpractice carrier will have something to say about how you're going to interact with patients in that manner. Mm-hmm. So it's an evolving area, and one that I think that patients should definitely keep their eye on.
Yeah. So the argument for doing this is so that there would be some kind of central place where your health records would be stored. And
correct.
So that would mean that any physician, you might go to different physicians in different places, in different parts of the country.
Right.
You might be someplace and there would be a medical emergency.
Correct.
And so the people then taking care of you could tap right into it. They could know who you are, pre-existing conditions, allergies to medicine.
Absolutely.
All that kind of stuff.
My prenatal records are like that. It's an actual web-based secure mm-hmm. system. Patient has password. And if she presents to any emergency room in the United States, if they have internet access, they can have access to the most updated form of her prenatal record. And they can tap right in. If they call me, I can give them a log-on access and just to her record. Wouldn't have any other patient access, just to her record. And they can find out exactly what's been going on in her pregnancy, all my notes, the plans for her care, because we have the plans of what is supposed to come next in her care. And it's really been a tremendous benefit. Nationally, there's been a huge push for getting prescriptions by essentially a faxing program where electronically we're going to input information, and it will have so much in there about the patient's allergies, what other doctors are faxing in prescriptions, and it's really going to incredibly add to patient safety.
Yeah. There seem to be some obvious benefits. One other question that I want to ask, and I'm interested in what you have to say about it, because the concern has been raised about privacy and who potentially would have access to your medical records.
That's always a problem. And yes, definitely not just who you give access to, but who may get access.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, this has always been true. I mean, even back in the days when we would request patient records and you're just requesting somebody's records be Xeroxed, you couldn't always be sure you were obtaining all the Xerox papers that you thought that you were obtaining in the right patient name. And you know, there are people with very similar names out there. And security is definitely an issue that has to be looked at, and many of the best minds in electronic, internet, web-based security, so forth, are definitely looking at that. I mean, this has been a problem in industry for a long time, and of course, they're addressing this in medicine as well.
We have a caller. We'd welcome others. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Troupin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's with us every other month for a program about women's health. And if you have questions, it can be anything that she deals with in her practice, they're certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana to talk with, line one. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
The previous program was a pair of economists discussing health care, and among the things they said was that preventative health care did not pay out, and he pointed to things like cholesterol screening, I think blood sugar screening, and some other tests of this sort, and I believe he also said the prenatal care was not cost effective.
Well, I think he said it depended on how much you gave. I think he was making the argument that maybe a certain number of prenatal visits were positive, but past that point, maybe
that was spending. I think he did say that four were.
Yes, but I think yes, you're correct. They made some distinctions between, say, something like yes, cholesterol screening, saying that's not worth the money. But he also did say something like mammography or colonoscopy. He said, now that he, in his opinion, he said, now that was worth the money. So obviously he was saying maybe some things were worth spending the money and in other cases not.
He also made the point that the hospitalization tended to go up with preventative health care. I don't think he addressed the possibility it was that people were simply getting health care they needed and did not get if they didn't have this. But at any rate, I'd like the doctor's opinion.
Sure.
Well, I tremendously believe in preventative health care, and I think in my field we can show not only lives benefited, wealth benefits directly in terms of the health and welfare of individuals, but we can show tremendous economic benefits. For instance, I was in the Gardasil development, the vaccine trial, and even after the first shot, within months, you can actually show economic benefit from getting the HPV Gardasil vaccine, which is just phenomenal. If you look at the introduction of a pap smear testing, we can show that pap smear testing was introduced and the rate of cervical cancer was decreased by about 70 to 80% within just a few years after the introduction of pap smear testing. So I can't say exactly what that might be in terms of dollars because I haven't looked at that in a long time. But in terms of health benefit for our population, just tremendous. And in terms of prenatal care, there are about 500,000 women that die worldwide of a lack of prenatal care and lack of trained health providers. And I do think that prenatal care is very cost effective. I would agree that we can reduce the number of actual visits. Some are strictly social, but some excess visits are necessary in the United States because you need to meet the provider that is going to be delivering your baby to be happy. And so sometimes you need a few more visits to encounter your provider. I haven't looked as closely at cholesterol and blood pressure screening monetarily lately, but if you tie it in with the obese population, I think that you will find that if you target the right populations, and just to summarize, because I see we're getting another call, if I looked at my crystal ball in 5 years, I would say that the Human Genome Project is going to radically change how we deliver medicine. For instance, when we know that someone is a BRCA1 or 2 carrier, in other words, carrying the gene that makes you drastically increase for the risk of breast cancer, we treat that person differently. They undergo different mammographic screening than the average person, and that is cost effective for that particular small segment of the population. And I think as we look to the future and we find what we all are at risk of, it will be cost effective to do screenings in the at-risk population. Where we've lost cost effectiveness is that we're using too big of a hammer at the little ants going by, if you know what I mean.
Yes. Do you think that preventative health care leads to a better use of things like flu vaccine and other?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the things I was going to talk about this morning is the fact that, for instance, if you get flu vaccination while you're pregnant, it prevents influenza in your infant up to six months after birth, which is tremendous benefit. These kinds of things, yet still, moms are somewhat reluctant to get vaccinated, or moms aren't offered consistently enough the flu vaccines in pregnancy. So we have underutilization of that very effective health strategy. So we need to spend our healthcare dollars in effective strategy and maybe steer some of our healthcare dollars away from strategies that are ineffective. And that's where those economists, which I missed that show, I'm sorry, but that's where economists can help us look at what might be effective and what might be a little bit less effective.
Thank you. Okay. I thought it's a blanket statement, and I thought a corrective another opinion was in order.
Sure.
Thanks.
Well, that's fine. Well, and I think that I think that they might well, you know, I don't want to put words in their mouths, but I think that they might well agree that the sort of the idea was that you have to look at, try to actually look at, well, where is your money best spent? What are you going to get for it? And I think that they would say something like, for example, I can imagine them saying, well, suppose we sat down and we decided we were going to screen everybody in the United States, we're going to screen their cholesterol. And then, but then you'd have to ask the question, okay, after we did that, would that really help us make a dent in the amount of heart disease in this country?
Well, Chris, David, we can go a step further. Yeah. In Europe, there is something called the poly pill. It got very popular around the year 2000. Mm-hmm. We didn't hear about it for a while, but I started hearing little reports. And the poly pill has, I believe, 6 ingredients. And it's really bad that I'm being put on the spot. I can't remember all 6, but it had a cholesterol-lowering medicine and aspirin and had folic acid and I think a blood pressure-lowering medicine. I believe it did have actually calcium in it as well. And I don't remember the 6th ingredient. But at any rate, the idea was you give this to the entire population over the age of 45 mm-hmm. and that you don't even screen.
You just give it to everybody.
You give it to everybody because yeah. you don't care what the cholesterol is. Everybody is better with a lower cholesterol. Mm-hmm. And that when they did some of the studies, that the benefits outweighed the risk for the whole population. Now, any one individual who gets a problem from the medicine might beg to differ. But yeah. at any rate, that was the poly pill concept.
Yeah. Okay.
Interesting.
We have some other folks to talk with and other questions. Welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Next up is a caller in Georgetown, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question in relation to taking, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, the drugs that are given for osteoporosis. Is it bisphosphonates or biophosphonates?
Correct. Bisphosphonate?
Bisphosphonates. Yes. Okay. I have been on, started out with Actonol, and I was having problems in the bowels, so I quit taking that, and then my doctor put me on Boniva. When I was taking Boniva, I started getting heart palpitations, and they did all kinds of stress tests, could not find any blockage, anything. So I said to my doctor, you know, one of the side effects of Boniva is heart palpitations. Do you think I should go off? And she said, yes, I think maybe you should. So I did, and I then had a catheterization. There was no blockage. They put me on Atenolol, which is a beta blocker, and I've not had any more heart palpitations since. This was last year in 2008. So I went totally off in about February of the Boniva. In August, we had some trees go down, and I was helping pick up branches and bending and moving and so forth. And after working all afternoon and probably dragging some limbs, et cetera, that were maybe a little too heavy, I started having pain around my chest, sort of felt like I had a rope squeezing around me. And then I have had problems with hip pain for the past few years, and so I'd already had a epidural, and it didn't work, but we went back to the doctor from the Spine Institute. She suggested that we take another MRI and see, and maybe we could place this epidural in a different place and possibly get some benefit this time. So when she took the MRI, when I went back to check with her, she said, well, we discovered another problem you have. She said, do you have pain in your chest? And I guess, yes, I have. I've had it since August. I thought I had pulled a muscle and dragging all these branches around. She said, you have a crack in your thoracic vertebrae. And she said, I noticed that you've gone off Boniva. You need to get back to your doctor, and you need to get on osteoporosis drug immediately because that'll help to cure it, clear it up. So I have been on Fosamax now since then. It took till about December when I didn't feel the pain anymore. And just recently I was talking with a friend who takes the News Gazette. And I told her, I said, I thought that the Boniva maybe was my problem with my heart palpitations. At least since I was off of that, I haven't had any problems. But then I did get the beta blocker also. And she said, you know, there was just an article in the News Gazette, and this was, I think, on the 10th of February, and she did send me the article. And it talks about these drugs and problems that they're having with them. These are the same drugs they give cancer patients, if I understand that right, with bone cancer. And so I just, by chance, talked to the pharmacist last weekend, and I said, what do you know about these osteoporosis drugs? I said, have you heard anything about them? And she said, no, not really, and I kind of told her what the article had to say. She said, the only thing that I have heard is that once you go off of them, you don't want to go off of them, because if you go off of them, your bones will then leach out as fast or faster than what they were before. And I'm looking back at what happened to me. I was off from February till I went back on Fosamax in October, and I ended up with this fracture in the vertebrae.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here.
Caused by osteoporosis. So I want some
okay.
What do you know?
So, I know a lot. I've done quite a bit of research on involved with many of these drugs, and we're not going to be able to cover all the questions that you have thrown into your story. But let's just start with some basics for the listeners. So osteoporosis is a condition where normal bone is somewhat demineralized, so you have an increased risk of fracture. And in order to prevent that fracture, we often will treat people who are either normal bone, but very high risk for some reason, but not too many, or someone who has lower bone mass, a condition called osteopenia, or some doctors prefer to wait until the bone is lower and in overall bone mass and actually has a diagnosis of osteoporosis. We usually make the diagnosis of osteoporosis with bone density tests. We've talked about those before. And the World Health Organization uses the cutoff of minus 2.5 standard deviations below the normal mean for a young adult as the cutoff for osteoporosis. If you have a better score, a thicker bone, but a fracture, and you can tell if you have a fracture by an x-ray, by the appearance of your vertebra on your density, or something called a VFA, a vertebral fracture analysis, which is a separate test that can be done on the more sophisticated bone density machines. And if you have a osteoporotic fracture, as no matter what your score is, you also have osteoporosis. And the different organizations have different guidelines as to who should be treated with a medicine. There are many classes of medicines that are available to treat individuals with osteoporosis. Forteo, which is parathyroid hormone, is the only medicine that can build bone. Somebody gets low enough in mass and needs to build bone, parathyroid hormone's the only way to do it. It's only approved for 2 years. It's an injection. It's expensive. You need to get pre-approval by your insurance company. It's the best bone-building medicine out there. All the other medicines out there prevent fractures in two different ways. They improve bone strength. Strength depends not only on thickness, but on quality of bone. They improve the quality of your bone, and they will probably maintain your bone thickness, but they won't build bone. Pain, that's a different story, a little bit more complicated, so I'm not even going to kind of go there, even though you had pain in your story. So what we want to do with our other medicines is we want to preserve the quality of our bone or improve the quality of our bone, and we can do that by slowing down the turnover. The only medicine out there that we use besides bisphosphonates, and there are a couple of different categories, we have bisphosphonates that do that. We have SERM, selective estrogen receptor modulators, like Avista, acts like estrogen on bone, will act anti-estrogen, helps prevent breast cancer. That's another drug that does it, somewhat similar mechanism. You can use estrogens to do it, and you can use another bone hormone called calcitonin. It's the sniffable one for anybody out there. But all those drugs do not build bone like Forteo. They maintain bone. 85% of people that are being treated for osteoporosis take a bisphosphonate. There are many bisphosphonates. They are unique. in some ways, but they all do approximately the same thing. They all have class effects. They all work by slowing your bone turnover down, bringing calcium out of your bloodstream into your system. They will not work if you don't have a good calcium level. When given intravenously, the drug Reclast can be given once a year. The drug Beneva, which is the way Sally Fields advertises it, you take it once a month, but it can also be given intravenously four times a year. Those intravenous drugs pull a lot of calcium in fairly quickly over a 1 to 2 week period of time. And it, when we study the intravenous ones, we noted a slightly increased rate of atrial fibrillation, the one of the small chambers of the heart, beating a little bit faster. So you might perceive that as a palpitation. Could happen with any of them. May or may not be related to this calcium flux, but it might be. We're not sure. So the FDA put a warning on all of them, but it was really something primarily seen in the intravenous studies. But all of them can have side effects, but we have given these to thousands of people when we talk about osteonecrosis of the jaw, when we talk about atypical fractures. Some of the rates of these things are rare, and the rates of maybe only a few per 10,000 individuals. But yes, anybody who has anything atypical needs to work with their individual doctor to figure out if whatever symptom they're having is tied into the bone. But one thing we know about osteoporosis drugs, very, very, very long half-life. Fosamax, half-life extraordinarily long. They've done studies and you hold your bone mass very well for a full year after stopping your drug. Estrogen, the effects wear off in a couple of years. But nobody really goes into any speeded up or turnover. You just revert to the way you were. And as we go through menopause, we lose 2 to 4% of bone per year. As we age, we lose between 0.5% and 1% per year. So there are other treatments available, other classes of medication, and perhaps somebody having side effects on a bisphosphonate would want other classifications of medicine. And hopefully that'll be helpful.
Okay. Just one other thing, then this article that was in the paper, the dentists have found that these patients are having this, what they call ONJ.
Yes, osteonecrosis of the jaw, which in the original studies was about 1 in 10,000. The latest studies tried to quote a rate of 4 to 6%.
Right.
A lot depends on your definition of osteonecrosis of the jaw. And some of the papers that I was in the studies I was involved in, when we reviewed those papers, even just some pulling down of the gum was defined as osteonecrosis of the jaw. I'm not a dentist. I was just involved in a panel that was reviewing the data. And if somebody has serious dental problems or they're going to have dental work, it's probably something that they want to discuss with their individual dental provider before or after deciding which medicine to use.
Right. I've pretty much decided that I'm going to, you know, when I go to my dentist the next time, make him aware of this and make him to be sure to be watching my jaw, because apparently the jawbone just starts to disintegrate.
It can.
It breaks off in pieces. And they did say that the majority of those that are suffering from this are the cancer patients who've had big doses of these bisphosphonates.
They were more involved with some of the intravenous ones, like
right.
the Reclast, which is zoledronic acid.
Right. And I did have a friend whose daughter just took this. She's had a lot of problems with bone density and so forth. And she took that Reclast, and she ended up in the hospital for 5 days. She had a really bad reaction to it. I guess that's because it's such a high dosage. Is that, I mean, that more people maybe have problems with it?
I was involved in the clinical trials. In the clinical trials, anytime you want to know what went on in the clinical trials, you just go to the PDR, and it will give you the percentage of patients that did well or not. Or did not do well. And actually, most of the patients did extremely well, which is why it was then approved by the FDA.
Yeah, they're still saying it's a low percentage, that it's, you know, like 4% or something. It isn't a big high percentage, but they, you know, they did indicate we need to keep our eyes on it and study it. And now, did you say that there was some place we could go to look up some of these clinical trials or
physicians'
something?
Desk references, or you can go to the FDA site.
FDA.
Or even each individual drug company has a lot of tremendous information on their own websites.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Again, our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. She also is affiliated with U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign every other month, always on a Monday. She is here. We talk about women's health, and your questions are welcome. We have somebody standing by. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And our next caller is in Rockford. Line number one. Hello.
Howdy.
Yes.
I have a question about my wife, and I don't know if it's quite an appropriate question, but she has high blood pressure and diabetes and is taking medications for both of those. But occasionally she'll have something like a, she'll get diarrhea, and she gets so sick from loss of water in her system that she ends up calling a 911, goes to emergency. She can't get any insurance. She gets a $3,000 bill for going to the emergency room in the hospital. When we don't have insurance, can't get insurance on her. What should we do to about this situation?
Well, I think that in general, anything preventative is always helpful. Some of the diabetes medications can cause a lot of diarrhea. If she can find a low-income kind of a public health clinic, we have them here in Champaign-Urbana. In your region, you might contact the public health department and find out if they have something like that where she could get regularly established care, adjust medication. That often is a partial solution to less side effects from the conditions that she does have. Also, generally speaking, urgent care visits are more cost effective than emergency visits. So there are some clinics that reserve appointments for patients that can sort of walk in. So sometimes that is helpful as well. Also, just in general, for all patients, what we call TLC, therapeutic lifestyle changes, and for everyone. And, of course, I'm not, you know, speaking about your wife, but just for everyone. You get less salt in your diet. You get more exercise. You get better sleep. You do try to take a low-cost multivitamin, preferably one with some omega 3 vitamins. You do try weight management and achieving your ideal body weight, those kinds of things. Incorporate exercise, you know, park at the back of the parking lot, walk into the grocery store, those kinds of things. If you already do that, you try to walk faster so that you're out of breath. All those TLC, those therapeutic lifestyle changes, help every medical condition, but diabetes and blood pressure respond to them particularly well.
Yeah, okay, well, thank you. And she's doing most of that. See, this situation was she got so sick she thought she was going to die, and it was on a weekend, and she couldn't call her doctor. And so that's why she had the only resort was the emergency room. And then we got stuck with this $3,000 bill and from the hospital for just going there.
Yeah, that's tough.
Those are always difficult stories.
Yeah, I think that's probably about the best response that we can give. I hope that was helpful.
All right.
We also need to invite other people here. We have about 20 minutes left on the program with Dr. Truppen. And if you have questions, I know that she'll do her best to give you an answer. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455 is where there's some other things that you would just like to mention?
I thought I would talk about infertility treatment. And one of the other things that I didn't suggest to the other caller is, you know, in many cities, there are many organizations that do clinical research trials, and on clinical trials, clinicaltrials.com, and I think it's there's a government one. It's, I think, clinicaltrials.gov might be the accurate website. If it's not, email me. I'll try to figure out the accurate website where there are often clinical trials going on in blood pressure management, diabetes management, and sometimes when you have clinical trials going on, it is possible to have some of your care when you're a clinical trial participant covered by the clinical trial. And it's definitely a motivating factor for some individuals. So might be something to look into.
Okay. You mentioned this, but I thought this was really interesting in response to the earlier caller, that if you're a pregnant woman and you get your flu shot, the baby gets 6 months protection. So
that's another, it's
too late now for this year. But,
no, it's not too late. The flu season goes well into March or April, and it's still a recommendation that if you've not gotten your flu shot, you should get one. And as we know, older individuals do, their immunity wanes. If they got a really early shot, mm-hmm. some older individuals, it is recommended that they get another shot. And also one thing I learned this year that I hadn't known in past years, that they have discovered that smaller doses of the flu vaccine do work as well. Now, we don't have any mechanism to give people smaller doses at this point in time, but they have discovered in years of shortages that they can cut the doses down, and actually it's fairly effective.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of interesting.
Well, I get it. Well, I guess I'm glad I mentioned that, because I suppose I had thought that at this point it was kind of late to be going out and getting a...
But if you haven't at all, the flu season still is underway.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's talk with someone in Greenup. This is our next caller, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a predisposition to macular degeneration, and a light bothers my eyes. I'm sensitive to it. I just read that it is a symptom of Actinel. And would that be the same with Fosamax?
Well, they've shown just a very, very slight increase. And we think that all the bisphosphonates, if one has a side effect, that the other might. We also, for a while, we were thinking that hormone therapy had a protection effect against macular degeneration. Haven't seen any recent studies where they've looked at that. Most of the studies where they looked at macular degeneration and estrogen therapy were done in the 90s, quite old studies, and we were using much higher doses of hormones. And a lot of these studies are going to have to be reworked, because we don't know if the new lower doses that we're using currently are going to have some of these same effects, some of the protective effects against colon cancer and so forth and so on. But we would think that anything that might be a side effect of one bisphosphonate would probably be a class effect.
Should I ask my eye doctor about this?
Well, definitely you have to work with your eye doctor when it comes to macular degeneration, of course. And if they think it's medication related or something else, they're going to have to suggest adjustment, because there are definitely some adjustments that can be made.
My internist took me off Fosamax for 6 months, and it will be all right to go back on it in that time if she suggests it, correct?
It's probably going to be something you're going to have to work with your own physician on.
Thank you much.
All right. Thank you. Again, questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the other things, I don't know what order you want to take these things, but one of the things, and it ties into maybe some of our earlier discussion of prevention. You said that one of the things that you might talk a little bit about was some new way to predict the risk of breast cancer that a woman might have.
Yes, we're not really using it as much as we should, but there are many calculations that have been used to predict your risk of breast cancer, and the most commonly one is the GAIL scale, G-A-I-L, and the National Institute of Health and the National Cancer Institute used it in its studies on breast cancer prevention, the trials that looked at tamoxifen as a breast cancer prevention, and the trial that recently, the STAR trial, that looked at raloxifen versus tamoxifen for breast cancer prevention. And that is a simple formula. You can just type in GAIL scale, G-A-I-L scale. It asks you if you onto the, you know, Google it, and it'll, you'll come up to multiple websites that'll get you to where you can Google that and come up with a score. It'll give you a statistical risk calculation of your chance of getting breast cancer in the next 5 years and a statistical risk calculation of your chance of getting breast cancer over your lifetime. And then based on that, physicians look at that risk score and then make recommendations as to whether or not you're a candidate to actually take tamoxifen or raloxifen as breast cancer prevention. And definitely individuals who are at high risk for breast cancer might think then, in terms of back to the osteoporosis treatment, hey, maybe I can treat my low bone mass with a breast cancer prevention as well. Well, they started looking at actual bone density in this whole formula, and they have discovered that for looking at the rates of breast cancer over a long time, over about 8-10 years, that for each unit of increase in your HIP score on your bone density, you had an increased rate of breast cancer. So we're talking about two kinds of individuals. One kind of individual, so, you know, it depends on who you are. I mean, there are people out there at risk for breast cancer and at risk for osteoporosis. But in general, we're talking two different kinds of patients. So you might have been told, hey, you know what? Your bones are really, really thick. Your bones are fabulous. You do not have a risk for breaking your bones. But now this new study shows, guess what? This might be a marker for high estrogen status and increased risk of breast cancer.
So
using that in a formula might help your doctor, again, tailor your specific treatment.
Well, that's interesting to me because I would think if you ask this question, well, what are risk factors for breast cancer? I suppose the only thing that I would come up with, or the first thing I would think of, would be, well, what's your family history? Do you have close relatives who had breast cancer? Well, that for sure means you're at greater risk. And there may be some other obvious things in addition to that would indicate that a woman would be at higher risk.
Well, that's one of the most obvious, and a previous biopsy that showed atypia. And that's where this halo breast pap test then comes in too, because with the halo breast pap test, which has not widely been adopted yet, we can identify in a non-invasive way women who have atypical cells being excreted, and those women have just as much risk, possibly more in some studies, but about 4 to 5 times the risk of the average population as somebody with a very strong family history.
We have about 5-6 minutes left. We have another caller here. Let's talk with him in Urbana. Caller is on line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a general question about a 40-year-old woman trying to conceive a child and chances of having a healthy child. And I'll listen off the phone. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, we feel that rates of infertility start to go up about at 35, and then it's a graph that climbs fairly steeply into your early 40s. But still being able to conceive a healthy child is still very common. And we say the rate of birth defects, you know, when you're 20, your rate of having a Down's child is approximately 1 in 2,000. At age 40, your rate of a Down's child is about 1 in 45. So unfortunately, we do have that increased rate of birth defects, but 44 out of 45, so, you know, still. And that increased rate of birth defects leads to increased miscarriage rate. So where the rate of miscarriages in the general population is probably something like one out of five, one out of six. We don't always find out. And some people are just a little bit late on their period, a little bit heavy period. They don't even know they had an early miscarriage. But the rate of miscarriages in the early 40s actually probably is somewhere as high as one in three, maybe even a little bit higher than that. So those are some of the factors. And also some of the 40-year-olds have subtle abnormalities, insulin resistance, slightly elevated blood pressure, subtle things they don't even know about health-wise that actually could impact their pregnancy. But anovulation, it seems to be the biggest factor in being able to conceive. So anybody after the age of 35, if you haven't gotten pregnant within 6 months, we urge you to look into trying to work with your physician or your healthcare provider and find out if there's something that is going wrong and not allowing you to conceive.
And if you have a patient of that age, is there anything that really stands out that you would say to her about what you think it would be good to do or to not do that would be different from, say, you had a patient who was pregnant and was only 25?
You mean already pregnant or trying to get pregnant?
Already pregnant. I mean, things that you would say, well, I don't know, I guess anything that you would say would contribute to the chances of having a healthy baby, a good outcome. You know, anything you'd say you'd do differently because you're a little older.
Well, ideally, everybody should go in for a pregnancy planning visit with their healthcare provider. And actually, there was a new study recently that said that women in the United States are really skipping that visit and that women aren't doing enough prior to their pregnancy to stop their risky behaviors. They aren't really stopping their smoking, stopping their drinking, stopping their medications. The average number of medicines that the average American woman takes prior to her knowing that she's pregnant is something like 8. Really crazy high in studies.
Yeah.
I mean, just everything from whatever, cold medicine, of course. Some of this is a little bit weird because some of the cold medicines have 3 or 4 things in one pill.
Yeah.
So
you're counting over-the-counter?
Oh, anything.
Everything. Okay.
Everything from anything she's prescribed. Maybe she's still taking her birth control pills. She missed the fact that she was pregnant.
Yeah.
So getting in for that pregnancy planning visit, getting the blood work that you need to get, talking to your healthcare provider about your family history, about your partner's family history, figuring out when to stop your contraception, figuring out what to eat, what not to eat, those kinds of things, getting started on proper levels of folic acid and calcium and so forth prior to that pregnancy is so important for everyone. And getting screened for diabetes prior to pregnancy as you get older, those kinds of things are critically important. And most of it, we're playing catch-up once the patient comes in with that positive home pregnancy test.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a little bit of time left, maybe a minute or two. We had a question off the air, and I want to ask it because the caller asked it. And it is something that's a little bit more general. It would apply to anybody, male, female, whatever. But the person was wondering if you could talk a little bit about why it is that as we get older, our immune systems don't function as well, and are there anything in particular that we can do to try to maintain good immune system function?
Well, again, no smoking, exercise, omega-3, better sleep, better nutrition, all those things improve immune function. We definitely have worse immune function as we get older, probably because we have increased cell death turnover very slowly as we get older. So the overall immune system probably has to work harder. We probably have more exposure to toxins the longer that we live. We're out in a every time we walk outside, we're exposed to UV irradiation. That's part of it. You get up in an airplane, you're exposed to even more UV irradiation. So just for exposure to things that decrease your immune function. I don't know if we completely understand all the reasons that our immune cell, like our T cells and our B cells, do not work as well. But those glands break down over time, just like our other endocrine system glands break down over time. We have a natural aging of those glands, and we don't understand everything about natural aging. They've said that if we were able to preserve the immune system that we have at age 10 into old age, we could live to 1,200 or something. Does that mean you have to keep your job for 1,150 years or something? I don't know. But I'm like, who's paying for me to live to 1,200? I can't even figure that out. But anyway, so I think that's probably off the top of my head the best answer I can give.
Okay, very good.
And I wanted to very quickly, I know
yes.
we probably have
yes.
30 seconds, mention about one of the studies. We are recruiting a study. You can only be up to age, I think it's 38, and we are looking for infertile couples who have infertility due to anovulation. In other words, having only four or fewer menstrual cycles per year. And it's okay if you've had some treatment before. The partner has to have a normal semen analysis. But if you have any interest, you can definitely call 217-356-3736 and ask for our research team. Thank you.
Well, there, we'll have to leave it for this time around with the promise that next month and probably for the next couple of hundred years that Suzanne will be here.
Exactly.
As long as we're doing this. Maybe we'll keep doing that at least for a few more years.
I'll take my vitamins.
All right, good. Take your vitamins. We'll hope that we'll continue to do the show. She has a practice on our area. She's also affiliated with U of I Med School. Every other month on a Monday, she's here. We talk about women's health. And thank you very much
thank
for being
you.
Here. We appreciate it.